Lecture 36, East and West.
Hello, welcome to our last lecture. Today we'll continue our exploration of modern manifestations of themes from the great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition. In the previous lecture, we noted that Chinese thinkers make a constant appeal to history and natural cycles, but with an emphasis on practical, this-worldly philosophies that highlight harmony, balance, and social order. There's more. In Chinese thought, the family is often regarded as the model for social relations and the incubator of morality. This is basically a Confucian perspective, since three of the five primary relationships are within the family. Remember, there's ruler to subject, and then parents to children, which is a family relationship, husband to wife, older brother to younger brother, and then friend to friend. Mencius argued that human nature is basically good, naturally good, and that children's innate feelings of love for parents, reinforced by customs and teachings about filial piety, can then be expanded into respect for rulers or older people in general. The term Lao in Chinese, meaning old, is a compliment, and it's often attached to people's names. So you might talk about Lao Wang, you know, old man Wang, or Lao Shi means the old instructor, or Lao Ban means the old proprietor, and those are the regular words for teacher and for boss. These expressions show respect and deference, but on the other side of that hierarchical division, right, the superior side, government authority has often been rather paternal. At its best, there's a concern for the well-being of the common people, but there's also little sense of private space. The government, like one's parents, can intervene in even the most personal decisions, from one's career, to residence, to internet usage, to how many children someone can have. There are always challenges to this family-based Confucian morality, from Mozi's impartial caring, or universal love, to the family-renouncing path of Buddhist monks and nuns, to Mao Zedong's attempts to completely upend traditional family life. But China today is still a country where the bonds between parents and children and siblings and even extended relatives are still extraordinarily strong, and the needs of family often take precedence over individual wants and desires. Though the one-child policy of recent years may well transform Chinese family life. Mencius's optimistic approach to human nature has another implication as well. There's a sense that everyone is potentially a sage. It's education and diligence that make the difference. In the U.S., we sometimes assume that certain people have a gift for, say, math or music, and so it might be pointless to try to develop talents that we don't have. In China, by contrast, along with other Confucian countries like Korea and Singapore and Japan, the assumption is that every child can succeed at math and science if only they're willing to work hard, and comparative international test scores seem to bear this out. In Japan, that's the theory behind Suzuki violin lessons, too. Okay, another theme in Chinese thought has been that politics that balance legal constraints against personal ethics. In contrast to India, where periods of a unified nation were the exception rather than the rule, China has had a strong central government for most of its history. This is due, at least in part, to the successful combination of a legalist administrative structure, remember, as articulated by Han Feizi in terms of laws, carefully defined bureaucratic responsibilities, punishments and rewards, okay, that administrative structures on one hand, and then that's balanced off with the humane dedication of Confucian scholar officials, who are granted a degree of flexibility in their decision-making. Today, laws and procedures matter in China, but often things get done through guanxi, or personal relationships, the sort of social connections that Confucius prized. There are no longer civil service exams on the Confucian classics. Those were done away with in 1905. But there is a highly competitive national higher education entrance exam administered by the government that, to a large extent, determines a person's future. As a result, students are under enormous pressure from their families to succeed in this test. And once again, this is an example of the government being involved in something that other countries might leave to individual diligence or private enterprise. Another theme from Chinese philosophy is a suspicion of absolute claims and values. Taoists like Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi argued that there were multiple perspectives to every question, and even oppositions such as yin and yang couldn't be exactly mapped onto good or bad. So it's like heaven versus earth. It's not that heaven is good and earth is bad. They're both necessary, and they work together. This is in contrast to the more Western-style dualism of good versus evil that we saw in the Persian thinkers Zarathustra and Mani. So in China, someone like Ge Hong could be both Taoist and Confucian at the same time. You can sort of balance those and harmonize them. And Buddhists like Fa Zhang of the Huayan school could bring together Theravada and Mahayana doctrines. Today in China, there's a strong urge toward cultural syncretism and harmony. Remember that you don't want to push an issue so far that your opponent loses face. In a similar manner, rather than assuming an inviolable, absolutely autonomous individuality, Chinese see personal identity as derived from relationships. Most of us are or have been both parents and children. We're supervisors in some relationships, we're subordinates in others. We belong to various associations or hail from different regions, all of which have claims on us and all of which make us who we are. A final theme from Chinese thought is a preference for the written word over oral communication. Remember, that's the opposite with what we saw in India. China has the oldest continuously used writing system in the world. And even with the reforms of Hu Shi, who called for writing in the vernacular rather than in classical Chinese, there's still tremendous affection for fine calligraphy and ancient expressions, such as the four-character aphorisms that are called Cheng Yu that I've mentioned a couple of times. I remember the first Cheng Yu I ever learned. It was called, referring to me and said, "Oh, you're Da Zhi Roy Yu." Now that's classical Chinese, where each character is an independent word, and from the syllables, you can't tell what character it is. So I said, "What do you mean by that?" And they said, "Oh, this is an expression from Laozi. It means great wisdom looks like stupidity." I said, "Okay." And then later I thought, "Hey, should I be flattered or offended by that? Was it the great wisdom part or the looking dumb that seemed to remind them of me?" Many of the great minds of China first express their ideas in written form. Han Feizi comes to mind here. And the literary output of Chinese civilization is almost overwhelming. Not only are there massive standard histories started by Sima Qian, but it's also been estimated that up until about 1750, more books had been printed in China than in the rest of the world put together. A high rate of literacy in a difficult script is one of the great achievements of modern China. At the same time, there's long been an awareness that words, either written or verbal, can be an inadequate form of communication. Remember Laozi's warning that the Tao that can be spoken of is not the constant Tao. And Confucius once observed that fine words and an insinuating appearance are seldom associated with true virtue. In Huineng Zen Buddhism, there's a transmission of understanding or enlightenment apart from words. And Wang Yangming insisted that knowledge, usually expressed in words, that knowledge has to be connected to action. And finally, we can turn to Japan now, where we've seen another set of themes in the Do Hotel, in that conversation that was going on there. These themes include Confucianism adapted and transformed. In some ways, Japan is a Confucian country on steroids. From hierarchy to ritual to deference, Japan is something like China, but even more so. The Japanese language includes formal and informal forms, as well as honorific and gendered modes, depending on who you are and to whom you're speaking. The art of bowing properly in varying circumstances is very difficult to master for outsiders. Who goes first, and how long you bow, and how deep, and how many times. An appropriate reciprocal gift-giving, this is something that happens at particular times of the year, in addition to holidays and birthdays and travel, that it can be very very nuanced in the kinds of gifts that you give and when you return them and how valuable they are and all sorts of things. Confucianism was once viewed as inimical to capitalism. Remember that Confucius and his followers were wary of merchants who seemed to put profits ahead of propriety. But the astonishing economic growth of Confucian nations such as Japan and South Korea and Singapore and Taiwan has led some observers to wonder whether there isn't a Confucian work ethic based on self-discipline, loyalty, frugality, and diligence. A Confucian work ethic that might be an Asian counterpart to the famous Protestant work ethic posited by the sociologist Max Weber. A second theme from Japanese thought is an emphasis on group identity, consensus, and harmony. You may recall that harmony, or wa, was an important part of Prince Shotoku's 17-article constitution in the 7th century. Some of you may be familiar with Japanese management practices, which attracted a great deal of attention in American business schools in the 1980s, where quality circles, team building, bottom-up communication, and decision by consensus were seen as paths to competitive success. We saw early examples of this urge towards synthesis and harmonization in religion when various schools of Japanese Buddhism tried to harmonize divergent traditions that were coming over from China, and also in the way that Shintoism was assimilated to Buddhism and then to Neo-Confucianism. Nichiren was an exception when he was quick to assert that everyone else was just wrong. That's a minority point of view in Japanese culture. A third theme is a distinct aesthetic sense. From the outside, Japanese culture may seem very regimented, but it's tempered by a profound emotion and a keen aesthetic sensibility, such as we saw in Murasaki Shikibu's Tale of Genji, with its exploration of mono no aware, a sensitivity to things, especially things that are transient or passing. An example of this in modern Japan is the custom of cherry blossom viewing, where many Japanese picnic and drink under cherry trees during the week or so when those trees are in bloom. And the National Weather Service provides a helpful bloom forecast. This offers an opportunity to both appreciate the beauty of the flowers, but also to contemplate the fleeting nature of life. Japan has long had high critical standards of beauty and elegance, as we saw in Sei Shonagon's Pillow Book. Japanese design today is celebrated around the world, and visitors usually notice that Japanese food is beautiful in addition to being delicious. Manufactured goods are often compact and functional, with sleek lines and bright colors, but there's also a developed taste for what's old and irregular and faded, as in Senno Rikyu's advocacy of wabi-sabi. A fourth theme is the close connection between art and religion. Even though early Buddhism advocated a renunciation of the world and its pleasures, Japanese monks like Kukai argued that art could play an integral role in preparing the mind for enlightenment. Classic Japanese art, which is still revered today, displays a restraint and an understatement that's been very much influenced by Zen, from Zayami's plays in No Drama to calligraphy, rock gardens, the tea ceremony, and haiku poetry, which is still quite popular in contemporary Japan. And that haiku seems to be related to the enigmatic koans of Rinzai Zen masters like Hakuin. The simplicity and naturalness of Taoism have also been incorporated into Japanese aesthetic sensibilities. And then the fifth theme is an openness to foreign influences, with the ability to adapt selectively in order to meet local needs. Japanese civilization from the beginning borrowed from the great minds of China, and then when the Chinese model no longer seemed as useful, thinkers like Fukuzawa Yukichi urged his countrymen to borrow from the West. In each case, however, there was creative development rather than just slavish imitation. In some ways, as I mentioned, the Japanese became more Confucian than the Chinese, and the Japanese are now challenging the West in our own chosen fields of science and engineering and business. One aspect of contemporary Japanese culture that can be traced to great thinkers is the use of manners posters, which can be seen in subway stations, in parks and streets and overpasses. These feature slogans urging people to smile, be helpful, and not to annoy others. The journalist T.R. Reid, in an engaging book titled Confucius Lives Next Door, offers examples of signs in Japanese parks that say, "To preserve the grass for people who want to sit outside, let's do our jogging on the designated paths and not cut corners." Or another sign that says, "To make sure this is a park our community can be proud of, let's pack up our trash and take it home." Okay, contrast that with what you're likely to find in a U.S. park, like "keep off the grass," the sign might say, or $100 fine for littering. In Japanese manners posters, there's an appeal to moral principles for the good of the community, and an assumption that, with a bit of educational reminding, most people want to do what's right. And by now, you should be able to recognize the influence of Confucius and Mencius. Okay, as we've briefly reviewed some of the themes in this course and the influence they have in contemporary India, China, and Japan, perhaps you've thought, sure, but what does all this have to do with my life? I proposed three answers in the first lecture, and now it's time to revisit them. The first was, I think this stuff is interesting. There are so many different ways of looking at the world. And it's interesting to think, to imagine what your life might have been like if you had been born elsewhere. There are fascinating connections between thought and social institutions, or between metaphysics and ethics. How the world is it's constructed, how it's put together, and then how we should act within it. The second reason that you might care about this, as I said at the first lecture, is it's a small world. Perhaps you are the generation that had Western civ classes rather than world civilization. But Rabindranath Tagore said this in 1930. He said, "The races of mankind will never again be able to go back to their citadels of high-walled exclusiveness. They are today exposed to one another physically and intellectually. The shells, which have so long given them full security within their individual enclosures, have been broken, and by no artificial process can they be mended again." That's certainly more true now than it was in Tagore's day. Probably the most powerful manifestation of traditional Asian thought comes in the form of religion. You are likely to meet Hindus and Buddhists and Muslims, either in your hometown or as you travel. I don't think that all religions are equally true. That assumption does a great disservice to the unique claims of various faiths. But I would like you to consider the possibility that great religions are equally legitimate. That is to say, we can acknowledge that people who believe differently have valid, thoughtful reasons for embracing their own faith traditions. We might even be able to imagine how such beliefs might make sense for them, and that's a step toward cross-cultural understanding and harmony. But what if you're pretty content with your own religious beliefs, or lack of them? What might the great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition have to offer? And now we come to the meaning of life. In the first lecture, I listed five great questions. I'll get to those in a minute. But first, let me offer an expanded version of the search for meaning. As someone who listens to teaching company lectures, you're probably the sort of person who cares about finding truth and goodness and beauty. Indeed, it may well be a lifelong quest for you. And I think that Asian thought offers enrichment and wisdom, as well as possible answers to life's big questions. I'll start with enrichment. Some elements of Asian culture have become part of the West. Think, for example, of Japanese words that have made their way into the English language. Anime, bonsai, futon, haiku, hancho, karaoke, karate, ninja, origami, rickshaw, sudoku, sumo, sushi, tsunami, and zen. Okay. Of course, we could also make similar lists of loan words from Arabic or other languages, but one of the things I like about Western culture is how voracious it is. We sort of seek out and grab onto things from all over the world and then make it our own. It's easy to develop a taste for Asian art and literature and food, or to take an interest in Asian history and society. And the more you know about culture, and in particular the great minds who shape that culture, the keener will be your enjoyments. For me, informed consumption beats clueless consumption any day. So you might, for example, see a Japanese movie, like by the great director Akira Kurosawa. And if you know something about the culture behind that, you'll be able to understand what's going on, and you'll be able to enjoy it much more than you would otherwise. There are Westerners who have already benefited from Asian practices such as meditation and yoga and acupuncture. If people find these useful, then I'm all for them, though I myself am a bit skeptical about grand claims that are sometimes made on their behalf. Still, I'm open to the idea that the human mind, and in particular the mind-body connection, is more complex than we sometimes assume, and that we might be able to learn from the many centuries of study that Eastern thinkers have devoted to mental processes. Okay, from enrichment, we're going to go to wisdom. The great minds of this course frequently offer insights into the human condition that, while not necessarily provable from a scientific perspective, may nevertheless be true. These ideas might also be useful or inspiring, and they're certainly worth considering. For example, Confucius once said, I quote Confucius a lot in this, very quotable guy. Confucius once said, by nature, people are nearly alike. By practice, they get to be far apart. Okay, is that true? Perhaps. It's worth thinking of and worth testing out. The Buddha once offered a list of key virtues that he called the four immeasurables. That's friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The same list also appears in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which was influenced by Buddhism. And you might ask, are these truly the highest virtues that we can seek after? Such fragmented insights and aphorisms are engaging, but do they really make a difference in someone's life or in a society? And here's where an understanding of entire traditions of thought comes in. Clearly, the East can learn from the West, and we've seen some of the struggles of Asian thinkers as they've tried to figure out how to adopt the benefits of Western civilization without losing their own traditions entirely. I love democracy and capitalism, science and technology, the rule of law, individualism, freedom of both worship and expression. And I think the world would be a better place if more countries had more of those qualities. But at the same time, it's worth pondering whether it's possible to take those good things too far. Is there such a thing as too much individualism, for example, or too much choice? Are there ever cases in which more technology makes us less happy? Is the constant threat of lawsuits really the best way to enforce standards? An unfettered democracy and capitalism can be both cruel and unjust, which is why we have the Bill of Rights and a regulated market system. Some of the Asian systems of thought that we've studied put more emphasis on, okay, here comes a list, carefully thought out list. So Asian system of thought can put more emphasis on social obligations, community, strong family, harmony, consensus, traditional morality, contentment, simplicity, nature, and spirituality. I'm not saying that those values are unheard of in the West, or that there isn't plenty to criticize in Asian history, but my point is that we can learn from each other. My examples of Chinese and Japanese politeness were simply part of ordinary living, but they offer a window into some underlying cultural patterns that are very significant and that greatly affect the quality of one's life. So we've gone from enrichment to wisdom, and now at last we return to the great questions of life. But you know much more now than you did before in the first lecture, so we can treat this as a kind of informal final exam. What is the nature of reality is the first question. And we've talked about Brahman and the Tao, or emptiness, which has no substantial existence apart from interrelated events of cause and effect. Remember, that's the Buddhist idea of dependent origination. What is the self? Is it something eternal, like Atman? Is it a social construct, as in Confucianism? Or is it an illusory manifestation of some cosmic whole, as in Hindu Vedanta philosophy? How are we connected to other people, to animals, to the natural world? And we've talked about samsara, reincarnation, and li and qi, principle and material force, and the Buddha nature. Is there a shared human nature? Mencius says human nature is good. Xunzi says, no, it's not. If you believe in God, is unity with God possible? Is it desirable? Is it inescapable? And remember that distinction between creator and creation that was so important to Sir Hindi when he was talking about Islam and Sufism, or the non-dualism of Shankara, the qualified non-dualism of Ramanuja, and the dualism of Madhva. Second question, how do we know what we know? We've seen arguments based on logic and historical precedent and hypothetical examples, as in the Warring States era in China, in the 100 schools of philosophy. Remember Mozi and Laozi, Weizi, the logician, Mencius and Xunzi, and Sunzi, the militarist, the strategist, and Hanfeizi, the legalist. But what about Buddhist meditation? Does that tell us something or help us gain some sort of knowledge? Or the yogic introspection of the Upanishads and Patanjali? Or the non-conceptual, wordless insight of Zen? We've seen some examples of proto-science. We've talked about Al-Biruni and Aryabhatta and Shangua. Science answers many questions, but perhaps not every question. And we've been cautioned about the existence of multiple perspectives. Remember Mahavira and the Jain story of the five blind men and the elephant, or Zhuangzi's fantastical comparisons that he made. Can you truly know something without putting it into practice, as Wang Yangming taught? Third question, how should society be organized? What is the relative importance of the individual versus the community? We've talked about Confucian filial piety and the karma yoga of the Bhagavad Gita and Jain and Buddhist monasticism. What's the role of religion in public life? Do you remember Ashoka, who was a very devout Buddhist himself, but didn't force that on his people? What's the proper scope of government? And that was a topic of conversation between Confucius and Han Feizi and Kautilya in India. How do women fit into society? Okay, we haven't done nearly enough on this. This is sort of a modern question. But still, long ago, Ban Zhao in Han Dynasty China talked about this, and we saw Murasaki Shikibu in Seishonagon in Japan. And then in the modern era, Fukuzawa Yukichi and Kang Youwei and Mao Zedong all talked about relation between the sexes. How open should we be to foreign influences? Remember Xuanzang, who went to India to bring back the Buddhist scriptures, or Shotoku, who did a 17-article constitution based on Chinese precedents. And then, of course, there are modernizers like Iqbal, Tagore, and Fukuzawa, who are all trying to determine how much should we borrow from outside cultures, and how can we integrate that with what we have ourselves. Fourth question, why do people suffer? In Zoroastrianism, it was an evil divinity who caused it. In other traditions, it might be karma, or ignorance is the source of suffering, or putting oneself at odds with nature, or materialism and selfish desire. Is the very notion of self problematic, as the Buddha taught? And what's the solution? For Jains, it's ahimsa, nonviolence. For Hindus, it's dharma, moral obligations. Mozi talks about universal love. And, of course, the various Confucian thinkers have all sorts of ideas for how to better organize society. And the final question, big question in life, how can we find happiness? We've seen a fair amount of practical advice for dealing with the challenges of life and death, along with numerous examples of thinkers who took delight in virtue or in nature, in community, in art and learning. And these are inspiring figures. The great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition can enrich our lives, challenge our ideas, suggest possible alternatives, and help us rethink and refine our opinions. Now, where do you go from here? Now that you've got a good sense of the sweep and the variety of Asian intellectual history, you may want to go back to the first lecture, to the beginning, and listen to this course again to absorb more of the details. By all means, get your money's worth. You might also want to try to read some of the key texts. Remember that intellectual history is cumulative. It's not displacing like science. So it's still very much worthwhile to go back to some of the earliest of the great minds that people are still arguing with and talking to. The Penguin Classics series offers inexpensive, good translations of many of the books we've discussed. And I would particularly recommend the Analects, the Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu, the Bhagavad Gita, Murasaki's Tale of Genji, if you like novels, and Seishonagon's Pillow Book. These are all important, delightful, and reasonably understandable to newcomers. If you want to go deeper, try Zhuangzi or the Yoga Sutra, and Hakuin's autobiography. And for the modern era, perhaps Iqbal's Reconstruction of Religious Thought in Islam, though you should first read the Quran. The Penguin Gandhi Reader is a nice compilation of Gandhi's ideas and sayings, and Han Yong-un's Everything Yearned For is lovely poetry. But of course, your most important next step should be to try to make some use of the ideas you've encountered. Remember Confucius's famous words at the beginning of the Analects, to learn something and then put it into practice at the right time. Is this not a joy? I'll give you one last example. I tell my students, if you don't care about early Chinese philosophy now, someday you will, because someday you're likely to be a parent. And as a parent, you'll need to guide the development of your children, and there are only so many ways to motivate people. And I tell them about my daughter and learning to play the violin, which meant that for years at a time in our household, we had fights every day about practicing. Maybe you've taken music lessons or had a child doing that. These aren't terrible fights. It's not like Liza hated playing the violin, But at any given moment, there were probably three or four things that she would rather be doing. Okay, what am I supposed to do? As a Confucian father, I tried to set an example. So when she started learning to play the violin in kindergarten, I started learning to play the cello. I'd never learned a string instrument before. I would practice every day, and she would see me, and I would hope that she would follow my example. Ritual is important. You want to practice at the same time every day in the same place. We hoped that Liza would grow up thinking that Americans just practice their musical instruments after dinner. It's just something that we do. We talked about respect for her teacher, that you want to practice so that you won't disappoint Miss Pam. And then finally, we would say, you have to practice so you don't bring shame on our family. Okay, this, it doesn't exactly work out the way I'd hoped. So now, what I'm left with Taoism, maybe. As a Taoist father, I'm very aware that she's hostile if I push too hard. And it's important to recognize that she chose the violin herself. When she was about three, we took her to a college performance of Fiddler on the Roof, and she said, I want to do that. Like, for 2 years, she said that. So we finally said, fine. And then we tried to make it natural by having lots of classical music on in the house all the time. Unfortunately, when she got a little bit older, it seemed like the music she was naturally drawn to was more like the pop music on the radio that had many more guitars and drums than violins. And then we come to legalism, punishments and rewards. And the good thing about legalism is it works. We could say, you know, no fun is going to happen until your practicing is done. Or if you practice every day this week, then maybe we can do something fun on Saturday. Legalism works, but only sort of. The problem, as Confucius noted long ago, is that if all the rewards are external rather than internal, it's hard to know how that's going to continue. The question is whether when Liza left the house, she would ever pick up the violin again or not. The jury's still out. She can play the violin. She doesn't play it a lot on her own, but she has those skills with her. We're hoping it will work. These sorts of ideas are still very applicable in today's world. One of the Buddha's insights is that all things, good and bad, eventually come to an end. And that includes this course. I've enjoyed it. I hope that you have. Thanks for spending your time with me and with some great minds from the Eastern intellectual tradition.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at thegreatcourses.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.